Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezi Eris.
Well, today is Wednesday. It's February 2. I can't believe we're already in February. It seemed we were in January. But anyway, I'm so thrilled that we have an opportunity today for the first time ever to be introduced to none other than the Honorable Ada Medina. She was recently appointed to the Yonkers City Court as its justice. And she got that position, being appointed by the mayor of the city of Yonkers, Mayor Mike Spano, when Judge Thomas Quiñones won the election to Supreme Court justice. So a very, very compelling story about Ms. Medina. And what's very interesting is she joins a very august group of people who are on the bench. You've got the Honorable Karen N. Best, the Honorable Arthur J. Duran III, the Honorable Evan Inlaw, the Honorable Daniel P. Romano, the Honorable Veris B. Shako, and the Honorable Elena Goldberg Vasquez, all on the Yonkers City Court bench. I see that the judge is on the line now. Let's welcome her in. Good morning, Judge. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure, really, just to meet you on the air, which is really wonderful. Congratulations on your position. There's not much time to get comfortable in your position because there's so much that lies ahead. But before we go into the future, let's learn a little bit more about you. Because here you are, you're a lifelong resident of the city, and you graduated from Northeastern University School of Law back in 2002. What made you consider going into law? What was the impetus for you?
Well, so it kind of goes back to the 80s and my family. In the 80s, the mid-80s, I would say, crack epidemic came on the scene, and family, friends, neighbors, got involved in drugs. And I wound up going to court a lot, actually, with my family. And I saw, the court system. And so that, when I was about 13 or so, I would say, I said, I want to be a lawyer, and so I worked, that was my singular goal. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I knew I needed to get a scholarship in order to go to college and law school. And so I just worked hard in school in order to achieve that. And, that's kind of what fueled my desire to go into law.
And when you went to court and when you were a witness to what was going on in the community in which you lived, what is it about the law that you recognize would give you an ability to counter some of the deleterious aspects of life? Because life was tough in the 1980s, and it still is today.
Absolutely. I think the big issue I had was that I felt that people who were just struggling with drug addiction were, being incarcerated and, put in jail. And I felt like what they really needed was, treatment. And so I felt like if I became part of the system, I could sort of help, get help for, my community and help them get into treatment rather than just be sent to jail.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people are starting to recognize that, something that you recognized, I don't know how many years ago. But that's very, very interesting. Do you think that we're moving in that direction? Are we becoming a little bit more aware that we can't just permit drugs to inculcate our society and then think that everything's going to be all right and that we need to make a change?
I think there's been a lot of changes. Yeah, I think there's been a lot of changes made to the justice system, the initiation of judicial diversion, which was a law that passed, I want to say, somewhere around 2005, 2006, with all the drug reform laws, where they codified the ability to go to, drug treatment for certain levels of crime, nonviolent crimes, particularly in drug crimes. I think definitely those movements have been, happening since I became a lawyer, which is, obviously was what I had hoped as a little girl would happen. So definitely there have been changes towards that end.
So, you know, before you got into to the position of being recognized as a judge, how did you, in a sense, earn a living, and how were you involved in community where you were able to begin the process, maybe not being a judge, but being a lawyer representing people who were not being treated fairly or were treated with bias as opposed to with respect? Where did you go from there?
So after graduating law school, I was able to secure employment with the Legal Aid Society of Westchester, which is located in White Plains, but it serves all of mm-hmm. Westchester. And so I became, in essence, a public defender, but it's a criminal defense. We don't have public defenders per se here in the county, but it's a criminal defense attorney whose legal aid is assigned by the court to handle all of the felony criminal cases in Westchester County, unless there's a conflict. And so I became a staff attorney there back in 2002. It was my first and only job since law school until now as a judge. And I began working actually in Yonkers. They had asked me when I interviewed whether I'd be comfortable working in my own community. I said that's exactly why I wanted to do this, is so that I could work in mm-hmm. Yonkers and help my community. And so that's what I've been doing for almost 20 years. I would have made 20 years in September.
Really? Wow. And mm-hmm. I understand you also served as a board of director at the YMCA in Yonkers.
Yes, I still am.
And you're still there? Wow, fantastic.
I am. I started with the YMCA of Yonkers back in June 2020 as a board member. And last March, I became the board chair. And so I've been the chair, and I'm still the chair of the YMCA. It's an organization that, you know, obviously is very embedded in the community to help, you know, everyone. And mm-hmm. it was someplace that kind of, you know, is very near and dear to my heart. I used to go there in high school to exercise mostly, and it was just a great place to be able to go to after school and, you know, not, you know, just do something productive and positive, right?
Yeah, and it was also safe, I think,
yes,
in a bastion
absolutely.
Of the lack of safety, which is really very interesting. I don't know how they became that, but they certainly evolved into that, and it's become known as mm-hmm. part of their legacy. You attended the Yonkers Public Schools, and you graduated with honors from Gorton High School, and you always had a commitment to Yonkers. What was it about your family lifestyle that, I guess, like, pushed you to consider Yonkers needing your type of input, because it seems like you were like guided somehow there. I don't know how that happened. Probably mom and dad, you know, said, well, this is a good place to do the work.
I don't know. I guess it's just, you know, growing up here, just having really strong connections to Yonkers, being in the public schools. You know, I went from kindergarten through high school in the public schools uh-huh. and I, yeah. you know, graduated from Gorton, as you said. You know, I don't know. It's just something that was always within me to give back to the community and want to help out, you know, my fellow neighbors and family and friends. And I couldn't say it's sort of, I don't know. It was always in me to do that. You know, even, you know, when I was in college, my last, you know, year before I graduated, I interned for the city of Yonkers, and then I returned for a year in between college and law school to work for the city in what was the Management Information Systems Department back then. I don't know if they still call uh-huh. that, but it's basically the IT department. So I worked there for a year in between college and law school.
Oh, that was Mr.
I don't know, public
Mr.
services
Kikace?
Is something I like. I'm sorry?
Yeah. Was that with Mr. Kikace? Bob Kikace,
no,
I think?
No, at that time, our commissioner was Linda Infante, who I think has since retired.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that person at all. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Do you find that the court system has somehow becoming more enlightened in the manner by which it adjudicates cases and in which it oversees it? Is the court system more sensitive to some of the problems that have been overlooked by society, more responsive than ever before?
I would say that since I was a little girl till now, there's definitely much more mm-hmm. awareness I think, in, you know, just society in general and how socioeconomic issues play a part in how people are treated within the justice system. So I do think that there's been great efforts made in the court system to be aware mm-hmm. and to take, you know, those things into account when you are adjudicating, you know, in the criminal realm. You know, obviously this is,
right.
you know, I haven't worked in the civil realm, but in the criminal realm, I would say that there has been a lot of progress made for sure in taking into account just, you know, people's plights and their socioeconomic backgrounds and histories and just things that come into play that bring people into the criminal justice system. Because, you know, I'm not sure, you know, from my perspective as a young girl, it didn't feel like that was as relevant. But now for sure, you know, I think that judges are much more aware of, you know, all the things that can come into play into someone's life.
Mm-hmm. And what about society, including judges that preside over any particular court? Have they been biased because of the color of somebody's skin or for because of their gender, or some other concerns? Have we been blind to that, or now, are we now more aware of it? And maybe a little bit reluctant to be as quick to the draw or to dismiss people? Because I guess a lot of people who come to court are not recognized or not respected somehow. Is that demeanor changing as well?
I don't necessarily agree with, you know, what you're saying in terms of that, in terms
okay.
of, you know, uh-huh. biases and that kind of thing. But
okay.
I think that with all of the, you know, the inclusion and equity work that's been done, I think that
mm-hmm.
if there were biases that someone may have had, you know, I think that people are definitely more aware. Everyone in the court system, I think, is much more aware. And,
uh-huh.
you know, so I, you know, I don't want to say that that's
no,
something
I hear
I've
you.
Seen,
I,
you know.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fine. You know, it's just what I've read. It's not like I go to court every day and see what's going on
mm-hmm.
there. That's part of reading, not because of my personal life. There's so many opinions, it's hard to tell what's real and what isn't at times.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what are the challenges that you find now that you preside over the Yonkers City Court? Are there unique aspects that you need to preside over? Are they still socioeconomic? Are they still somehow informed by race or gender or something else? What are the challenges to the court, to you as a judge?
I think the greatest challenge that's happening now within the court system, and I think society in general, is the mental health crisis that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has become now the major, you know, whereas when I was a child, my perception was that it was drugs. I think that now at this time, mental health is playing the biggest role in, you know, in the justice system and in society at large. I think we're experiencing a lot more mental health crisis among a larger group of people than ever before. Or maybe we're just more aware of it. You know, maybe it's just more
mm-hmm.
at the forefront and we're more aware of it. I'm not sure. I haven't
mm-hmm.
read studies, but, you know, that's just my perception.
And based on your perception, how do you see it exemplified where somebody may come before your court and you believe that there are some issues with regard to stability one way or the other? And does that come into making a judgment call or not? I mean, I have no clue because I've never been a judge.
Well, I think it depends on what you're talking about in terms of, you know, the kinds of cases. You know, at this point, I'm not sitting in criminal court as a judge because I need because of my position at Legal Aid as a supervisor and for how long I was supervising and
uh-huh.
dealing, I handled thousands of cases over the years. So I'm
right.
not sitting in criminal court, but I imagine that You know, mental health does play a role in, you know, potential dispositions and how things, you know, come about. I think in the civil realm, particularly in the landlord-tenant court, you know, that could potentially be something that is a factor in, you know, the ability for someone to pay. You know, it could have affected, you know, their ability to hold a job or, you know, even to seek services in order to pay. So, you know, it does affect a lot of different parts of our society and the justice system.
So you were really talking about the socioeconomic situation, probably informed by like COVID and the crisis that we've had for 2 years, where a lot of people lost their employment or they were underemployed or businesses shut down and people were in arrears with rent and so on and so forth, all kinds of issues. And I think criminal conduct also went on the rise. So, you know, it was all seemingly socioeconomic, I would think. That could have been the initiator of it all, or the catalyst to bring all this about. It may have only exacerbated it more so in the last 2 years. Well, who knows when we're going to come out of it. Hopefully it's going to go away, or at least be something like a regular flu shot that we get once a year, assuming that people want to get the flu shot, whatever it'll be in the future. So, and then what can a judge, like on the Yonkers City Court, what can you do to be a little bit more responsive to the needs of people when you recognize the complexity of who they are and what they're suffering? What can we expect from a judge?
Well, I think the most important thing, and I think that this has always been the case, is that as a judge, we have to be open-minded, respectful, and fair. Mm-hmm. We have to be willing to listen. You know, we have to be willing to listen to both sides, to every side, in order to make an informed decision about how a case should go and how it should be resolved. You know, those are the most important things. And, you know, just listening out for, you know, all the factors that could affect, you know, why someone is before you and what potentially brought them there and what could be the right, you know, resolution or the fair resolution.
And is that something that you get a notice of in advance before a case comes before you, or is that the responsibility of the lawyers representing whatever parties stand before you? So that has to be explained by the lawyers, and then you're supposed to be able
In criminal court, I would expect the attorneys to bring that to the court's attention, to bring any issues that they think are relevant to the judge making a decision. You know, in civil court, sometimes it's a little bit different because there are some people that are unrepresented. So I think it's also our responsibility to sort of engage in a little bit of conversation to find out if there are any issues that are affecting someone and their ability to even represent themselves. You know, I think, you know, we try to encourage them to obtain an attorney, and there's a wonderful organization by the name of Legal Services of the Hudson Valley, which is a nonprofit organization which provides civil representation as opposed to criminal. And so the court does, you know, encourage litigants that are unrepresented to reach out to them and try to get their advice and help.
And then how do you feel, you know, now that you're appointed by the mayor, so you really have the full year before you, but then you also have to go through an election process because the Honorable Judge Quinones, he left about a year on the table, so to speak, when he moved into the Supreme Court. So is that going to be very difficult to find the time not only to preside on the court, but also to campaign for a re-election?
I don't think it's difficult in the sense that, you know, I can campaign after work and on weekends and that type, you know, obviously during work hours I'm at work and I have to, you know, abide by my duties and my responsibilities. So it is, mm-hmm. it's more work on me. You know, it's more,
yes.
it's a lot more work that I have to do, but it's not something that I'm not used to. You know, when I worked yeah. as a defense attorney, there were often times that I had to work on the weekends or work after, you know, stay after work because, you know, when you're a salaried employee, it's not just, you know, I clock in at 9 and I clock out at 5 and that's it. You know, you have responsibilities
right.
to do the work and get it done in the timely fashion that it needs to be done. So I'm not, you know, this is not foreign to me to work, you know, extra or after work or weekends. So it's just a different element for me in the sense that I'm not and never have been a very political person. And I tend to be more introverted and focused on my work. So I've had to sort of shift, and obviously now I'm in the public eye and meeting with, you know, the community and people out there in a more public way. So that's been a little bit
mm-hmm.
of a shift for me. And that's been a little bit harder. But I think that, you know, because I'm used to public speaking, it's not tremendously different for me. So, you know, I think it'll be fine. I'm enjoying, you know, meeting with all the different people in the community, the politicians, and, you know, it's been interesting. It's a sort of interesting start, and, you know, but it's been good. The balance is fine, you know, and court obviously is wonderful. I love going to work every single day. I look forward to it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so far, so good.
People in- Yeah, it sounds good. I think people in the city are clamoring to get to know you. They probably want to just like shake your hand and stuff. Do you speak any foreign languages? Does it ever come to a point where there may be a need for an interpreter when they come before a judge?
Absolutely.
Does the court supply that? Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
I wasn't
absolutely.
Sure.
The court has. Yeah, the court has an obligation to provide an interpreter to any litigant that needs it. We do have
uh-huh.
a full-time, we actually have, I believe it's, I want to say 2 or 3 full-time Spanish interpreters in the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always available to help our litigants that speak Spanish. I also speak Spanish.
Oh, great.
And, yeah, so if there are other languages that are needed, once we become aware, we typically, what will happen is if we can get someone the same day, we try to get someone the same day. Otherwise, we will reschedule the person for another day that we can
uh-huh.
bring the interpreter in to help them.
Right. That's very exciting. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then is it difficult to keep up with the law on a local level? Does a local law change very much, or is it more static? Or is it more volatile in other courts? Does it make a difference? Are there a lot of changes that will impact the Yonkers City Court?
Local laws, I will say, generally stay pretty static. The only thing that
mm-hmm.
we have to keep up with and that is nice is that we get essentially a bulletin every day where,
mm-hmm.
you know, if there are new cases that have come out, anything that would affect, you know, precedent. You know, we get those every
nice.
Day. And so, you know, you read them like the newspaper, you read them every day. And
right.
so that's how you kind of keep up. And then we also have, requirements to take, they're called continuing judicial education coursework, which is similar to what lawyers take, which is continuing legal education. So you have, you know, a certain number of courses that you would take throughout the year in order to stay up to date with any changes to the law that happen.
Oh, wow. Fascinating. My goodness. So, wow. So what do you have to do from a political perspective? Do you have to go out and raise funds? What are some of the responsibilities of becoming a candidate? Because it seems like you've got the jurist aspect of it in place, so it doesn't seem to be a challenge there for you. Who comes to your defense when it comes to running for a political campaign?
Well, so I have to have a committee that basically is in charge of the fundraising because as a judicial candidate, we are not allowed to solicit any funds. We're not allowed
to
donate to our campaigns. Yeah, we're not allowed because in order to preserve impartiality, you can't know who donates to you. And so the committee has to do all of that. I have a separate treasurer
mm-hmm.
who has to do all of that. and keep track of the finances and expenses and anything that comes in. And so, you know, I would say that's been, you know, the most, you know, difficult part, because I've never had to do any of those things. I'm used to doing things all on my own. And so now I have to rely on my committee to do those types of things for me. But so they will be the ones in charge of any type of fundraising events or anything like that. And then I'm basically, you know, the things that you have to do for the campaigning are, you know, obviously expend money for, you know, ads and things like that. The I think the most challenging part will be, you know, going door to door to get our petitions. We have to get a certain number of petitions in order to actually get on the ballot. It's not automatic that I get on the ballot because I'm an appointed judge. So we have to be able to get our petition signed in the time that's required by the Board of Elections, and submit them, and then, you know, get on the ballot. So I think that's the most challenging part, is going door to door and, you know, meeting the constituents and getting the signatures that we're required to get. So I definitely need volunteers for that.
Okay. Okay. Well, you heard it here first. She needs volunteers for that. And and then, so what about once you get that whole process going, I guess volunteers help a great deal. I guess they help collect signatures. And is there, when one runs for election or re-election, in your case it would be re-election, do you have to run also under a political party line? Or do you do it just like under your name, Ada Medina?
No. So, well, I'm a registered Democrat, and so I would run under the party that I'm registered under. I think generally, you know, any candidate can, you know, if they get sufficient signatures, they can run under, you know, whatever line if they're independent or whatnot.
Oh, really?
I think you just have to get the requisite signatures. But, yeah, so I, you know, as a Democrat, I would run because I'm in a party already, and so it would be as a Democrat.
Okay. All right. That's very interesting. Do you find that there seems to be greater strength in the Democratic Party at the moment, or the Republican Party, the Conservative Party? They might be a Working Families Party. There's so many parties to belong to. So who knows? Can you run on all four or five? I don't know how many there are.
I wouldn't know because it would be too confusing
for me.
I couldn't say about that.
Okay. All right. Very, very interesting. Well, any last words from you before we conclude our segment? And hopefully I didn't scare you to death, because, you know, I'm really an easygoing guy, even though not everybody thinks so. But whatever. You know, that's another issue. We could discuss that next time if you're willing to come back. And how do people reach out to you if they want to help you? Do you have, like, a website or do you have a phone contact? How does one do that?
So I have an email that they can contact, which is judgeadamedina@gmail.com. They can send an email there. I also have a Facebook that the committee set up, which is Elect Judge Ada Medina for Yonkers City Court. So they can, you know, follow and like the page and reach out to us that way if they'd like to volunteer.
That's terrific.
And
it looks like you're all set.
I appreciate being here. Thank you so much. This is my first interview in this process, and so I really truly appreciate
I just want the people
to know. Well, hopefully. And it's a few months before November, so we've got plenty of time to come back, and, you know, I'll be happy to come back anytime you want. What I want the people to know is that, you know, they can reach out to me anytime. I'm an open book. There are certain things I can't talk about because of judicial ethics rules, in terms of, like, you know, that's, I think, the hardest part, is that, you know, people are used to asking politicians about where they stand on certain issues. As judges, we're not allowed to take any political stance, because we have to be impartial. That's the point. We have to come in. That's what blind justice means. We have to come into the courtroom and be able to listen to the case that's before us and make this decision based on the case before us, not based on our outside opinions or our personal beliefs. All of that gets checked at the door whatever you may believe
right.
personally, that has nothing to do with the justice that we have to provide in the courtroom.
Well, luckily you've come to me because I've learned that lesson many, many, many years ago. So I don't ask political questions when it comes to that. Well, all the best to you. I'm very thankful that you're on the court. You join a really wonderful group of people, and I would imagine they would also help you if you ever needed any help.
They've been wonderful. They've been wonderful.
Terrific.
Yeah.
That's good.
No, my other judges have been wonderful. Yeah, they've been very helpful at helping me navigate, you know, just becoming a judge and training me, and I've been observing. Mm-hmm. I've observed all of them, so it's been wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, all the best to you, Ada Medina. What a pleasure. Thank you for making the time for our
audience.
Thank you
so much.
Be well.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful
day.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, here we have it, folks. Ada Medina. She's serving as city court judge here in the city of Yonkers, graduate of Northeastern University School of Law, and now presiding, at one time she presided as the region chief at the Legal Aid Society of Westchester. And now, of course, she's on the Yonkers City Court as a judge, recently appointed by Mayor Mike Spano, the mayor of the city of Yonkers. And she's a Yonkers resident to boot. So, I don't know, it's somehow very, very exciting to find people who were either lived here a great length of time, or that were born here and then went through the whole process of literally being inculcated with so much of the culture of the city, and, you know, rising to a level of accomplishment where there's recognition for all their work and their input into society. Very, very exciting. So it was what a pleasure to meet her, that's for sure. Well, let's just move on to another place here. Bear with me a moment. Got to get rid of some of the pages. Some very interesting things are happening. Bear with me. Where did I have here first? I wanted to look this up. Well, I'll go in order as I find it right now. Evidently, United States troops are going to be deployed to Eastern Europe in coming days. That's what a U.S. official has said. Well, it seems that President Joe Biden has approved an additional U.S. military deployment to Eastern Europe amid a standoff with Russia over Ukraine. And the Pentagon is expected to announce today that troops will deploy in the coming days. That's what a U.S. official had said. But Biden has formally approved the troop movement, and he advised Reuters of that effect. And the U.S. military last week threw 8,500 troops or gave them notice to be on alert to be deployed to Europe and if needed. So potentially on every short notice in the latest effort to measure jittery NATO allies in the face of a Russian military buildup near Ukraine. And Biden is now sending roughly 2,000 troops from the United States to Poland and Germany this week. That's what a U.S. official told Reuters. And the Wall Street Journal reported the troops would come from Fort Bragg in North Carolina. So about 1,000 troops will be repositioned from Germany to Romania on NATO's eastern flank closest to Russia, the official advised. Well, the Pentagon this week suggested that troop movements could come from within Europe as well. Well, the U.S. troops notified of ready-to-deploy orders last week included additional brigade, combat teams, logistics personnel, medical support, aviation support, and troop forces involved with intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions. So very, very compelling, to say the least. We're going to see where it goes, really going to see where it goes, because a lot is on the line. And it's going to be very interesting as far as Europe's concerned. Ukraine may prove to be a wild card for inflation-obsessed markets. And that's something to think about as well. We hear out of the UK that with surging inflation and central bank policy occupying investors' minds, the traditional market playbook on how to react to military flare-ups has been thrown out the window. So unease over Russia's troops build up near the Ukraine border contributed alongside U.S. rate hike jitters to a 5% slide on Wall Street last month, yet top-rated government bonds and gold assets that typically rally when political upheaval or war threaten failed to benefit. Well, U.S. and German bonds, considered the safest assets of all, witnessed their worst month since early 2021, with yields surging 30 and 20% respectively, as inflation and the prospects of higher interest rates commanded the spotlight. Gold unbelievably fell 2%. It isn't often that stocks and bonds fall at the same time. And John Bragg, the global head of desk strategy at NatWest Markets, they're based in England, estimates this has happened in 35 months since 2000, or roughly 14% of the time. The inverse correlation between equities and bonds has long been relied on by investors to safeguard returns in times of trouble, with a 60-40 portfolio split one traditional strategy. Now, though, Briggs says that investors, quote, need to entertain the idea that markets could react differently when central banks are focused on responding to higher inflation. Well, if we do see a further deterioration in the Ukraine situation for investors looking for traditional safe havens, some of the old correlations may not hold. Markets' muted reaction to Russia or Russian saber rattling, it seems, denies it an opportunity to plan to invade its neighbor and may not come as a surprise to those who note that recent risk events, from missile launches to attacks on Gulf oil facilities, have had only a fleeting impact on investment behavior. What's different this time is that inflation, subdued for decades, is running hot in many countries. In conflict with Russia would further fan inflation fears by boosting oil and food prices. So those are some of the typical issues that are coming about, and it's going to be very, very compelling to see which way it's all going to go. One second. Sometimes it's worthwhile following what goes on in Europe because quite often the Omicron virus and stuff like that ends up coming here to the United States, and quite often they're ahead of us in negative as well as in positive situations at times. Well, it seems that a British COVID trial deliberately infecting young adults has been found to be safe, which is very interesting. Well, the world's first human challenge, quote-unquote, trial in which volunteers were deliberately exposed to COVID-19 to advance research into the disease was found to be safe in healthy young adults, leaders of the study said on Wednesday. Well, the data supports the safety of this model and lays the groundwork for future studies to test new vaccines and medicines against COVID-19 using this type of or this kind of trial by the end of this year, the team had added. So Open Orphan is running the project. The launch last February with Imperial College of London, Britain's Vaccines Task Force, and Orphan's clinical company, HVIVO. Well, scientists have used human challenge trials for decades to learn more about diseases such as malaria, flu, typhoid, and cholera, and to develop treatments and vaccines against them. The Imperial trial exposed 36 healthy male and female volunteers aged between 18 and 29 years to the original SARS-CoV-2 strain of the virus and monitored them in a quarantine setting. They will be followed up to and for 12 months after discharge. No serious adverse effects occurred, and the human challenge study model was shown to be safe and well-tolerated in healthy young adults, the company had said. Well, people in this age group are believed to be major drivers of the pandemic, and these studies, which are representative of mild infection, allow detailed investigation of the factors responsible for infection and pandemic spread, so said Chris Chiu, C-H-I-U. He's the chief investigator on the trial and professor of infectious diseases at Imperial. Well, the Imperial researchers said they now plan to start a similar study using the Delta variant and will share their framework around the globe to allow similar research. That could provide a crucial route to testing new vaccines, antivirals, and diagnostics against COVID-19 more quickly, particularly if transmission rates fall in the real world. Imperial said it could start tests like this using human challenge trials by the end of 2022. In April, Oxford University launched another human trial which sought to reinfect people to deepen understanding about immunity. Well, the result of the Imperial study published on a preprint server and yet to be peer-reviewed also provides some clinical insights that could inform public health policy. Well, researchers found that symptoms start to develop on average about 2 days after contact with the virus. That's what Imperial said, which is earlier than the widely held view that the virus has an incubation period of around 5 days. Hold on a split second. And the infection first appears in the throat. Infectious virus peaks about 5 days into infection, which is also when the most significant symptoms are usually noticed, the researchers said. And at that stage, the virus is significantly more abundant in the nose than the throat. They also found that rapid lateral flow tests were a reliable indicator of whether infectious virus was present, and therefore the person was likely to be able to transmit the virus. So most people had live virus in their nose for an average of 6.5 days, they said. So 18 volunteers became infected, 16 of whom went on to develop mild to moderate cold-like symptoms, including a stuffy or runny nose, sneezing, and a sore throat, Imperial had said. So some experienced headaches, muscle and joint aches, tiredness, and fever. None developed serious symptoms. 13 infected volunteers temporarily lost their senses of smell, but this returned within 90 days in all but 3 participants, and the remainder continue to show improvement after 3 months. There were no changes seen in their lungs or any serious adverse events. Only one person had, a slightly reduced sense of smell, which was improving. The trial used the lowest dose necessary to infect people, although the team said it was comparable to real-world infections. And the scientists will now study other elements from the trial, including investigating why the 16 of the 34 participants in the final analysis did not get infected despite exposure. Some had detectable virus in their nose but did not go on to test positive twice on PCR tests, the threshold the team used for confirmed infection. So very, very, very interesting to say the least. Now, one second. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but there is a game out there called Wordle. And I first learned about it through British Broadcasting, and they spoke about it. And now I hear, I think it was developed in the UK, and now it's said to have been purchased by the New York Times. I don't know how it works, but I'm going to look into it because it sounds very, very interesting and very compelling. So we'll have to see what's likely about it. Now, let's still cover something else with regard to Omicron. The Omicron variant, known as BA2, is likely to have the same severity as the original, so says the World Health Organization. And I think we read this to you yesterday. So the emerging BA2 form of the Omicron coronavirus does not seem to be any more severe than the original BA1 form, an official of the World Health Organization said yesterday. So I guess that's really interesting, and it's good that it's not more infectious or could be more deleterious to people, and that's really, really important. And now let's just look to see what else is happening on the world stage. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, let me move on to another page. All right, so bear with me a second here. Okay, I'm going to move on to another page. Bear with me a moment. All right. This is really, though, interesting with regard to Omicron. Evidently, Omicron has literally slammed the U.S. private payrolls in the month of January. It seems that in Washington we hear that the U.S. private payrolls fell for the first time in a year in January as soaring COVID-19 infections disrupted business operations, raising the risk of a sharp decline in employment that would deal a temporary setback to the labor market. Private payrolls decreased by 301,000 jobs last month after increasing by 776,000 in December. So the ADP National Employment Report showed that on Wednesday today, and that was the first drop in private payrolls since December of 2020. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast private payrolls would increase by 207,000 jobs. Well, the broad decline in private payrolls was led by the leisure and hospitality sector with 154,000 job losses. Trade, transportation, and utilities shed 62,000 jobs. Construction lost 10,000 jobs, and manufacturing employment decreased by 21,000. Well, Neela Richardson, the ADP chief economist, said that the labor market recovery took a step back at the start of 2022 due to the effect of the Omicron variant and its significant, though likely temporary, impact to job growth. So the ADP report is jointly developed by Moody's Analytics and was established, or published rather, ahead of the release on Friday by the Labor Department's more comprehensive and closely watched employment report for January. It has, however, a poor record predicting the private payroll count in the department's Bureau of Labor Statistics employment report because of methodology differences. Well, the ADP report counts all active workers as employed, regardless of whether they are paid or not during the survey week. In contrast, people who are out sick or in quarantine and do not get paid during the payrolls survey period are counted as unemployed in the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of establishments, even if they still have a job with their company. So the decline in private payrolls in the ADP report suggests that some workers were laid off because of a lack of business as COVID-19 infections driven by the Omicron variant slammed demand. And businesses were also probably unable to find workers with so many people at home because of soaring infections. According to the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, published in mid-January, 8.8 million people reported not being at work because of coronavirus-related reasons between December 29 and January 10. And this has left some economists bracing for a decline on Friday in the non-farm payroll count for January. According to Reuters survey of economists, non-farm payrolls likely increased by 150,000 jobs in January. Estimates range from a decrease of 400,000 to an increase of 385,000, and the economy created 199,000 jobs in December, the fewest in a year. So the White House has been frantically trying to prepare the nation for a disappointing non-farm payrolls number, with several officials offering a preview of the report. I think the key point from our perspective is the underlying strength of the economy. Jared Bernstein, a member of the White House's Council of Economic Advisers, told CNN this week, the underlying strength of the job market is ongoing because, as we have seen, the caseloads are turning over. Well, the United States is reporting an average of 461,097 new COVID-19 infections a day, sharply down from the more than 700,000 in mid-January, according to a Reuters analysis of official data. Well, demand for labor is strong with fewer workers available. There were 10.9 million job openings at the end of December, and the first-time applications for unemployment benefits have retreated from a three-month high at as the Omicron wave subsided, and that's the case there. So let me move on to another segment. Bear with me a moment here. And we're going to move over here. Bear with me. One second. Let's see if we can get here. Okay. Oh, an update. Evidently, the United States is going to deploy 3,000 troops to support NATO forces in Eastern Europe. Well, we're going to have some experts tomorrow. Former U.S. military have 20 years of service in Afghanistan, and they see a correlation between what happened in Afghanistan and what's happening now with Russia. Ukraine standoff, and so we're going to get a tremendous amount of insight by talking to them. It'll be very, very interesting what their input will be like. Ukraine's citizen soldiers are training to fight in case of a Russian invasion, which is really very, very compelling. Bear with me a moment as I try to get to this this issue. Bear with me a second. 1 minute. Oh, and then you hear the whole harangue from Putin. He says that the United States and its allies are trying to lure Russia into a war in Ukraine, which is the biggest BS if there ever was one. But I guess a lot of people actually believe that sort of stuff. It would be amazing to me how they could, but you just never know. It's just very interesting how that works. Okay, one moment here. Okay, bear with me a moment and hope that we can get this up. Definitely having trouble seeing, I don't know about you, but I've been having a tremendous amount of issues with the internet of late. Okay. Or let me start again from scratch. Maybe that'll help it. All right. Let me see if we can get there at least. And then maybe we could pick up the page. Okay. I don't think so. That's not coming through. All right, let me go back to the Yonkers Tribune website. I don't remember exactly what there was there that I wanted to share with you in today's program. I'm having even trouble there. Oh, my goodness. All right, I'm going to try it for about another minute, so I beg for your patience, and hopefully we'll be fine. One second. I have to find the pages here. Bear with me. Yeah, this is what I wanted to talk to you about. Hopefully this will come up. I think it is. Yeah. Ukraine citizen soldiers are training to fight in case of a Russian invasion. And that's really important to see because you don't always find that to be the case. So as tensions continue on the border with Russia, Ukrainian electricians, nurses, lawyers, and even priests are volunteering for the country's territorial defense forces as civilian reserve intended to support the regular army in case of a Russian invasion. Don't aim for the head, aim for the crotch. That way you're sure to hit your target, even if it ducks at the last minute. A Ukrainian instructor tells a small group of recruits dressed in camouflage clothing. Kalashnikovs in hand, the volunteers have been learning how to move in small groups without entering their comrades' line of fire. For these Ukrainian Territorial Defense Forces reservists from Kharkiv, the unit, that's a city, the enemy they're targeting is the tens of thousands of Russian soldiers massed just on the other side of the border. And also from Belarus as well, the neighboring, Soviet entity right under Russia itself. So, and also on the border with Ukraine. So many of these volunteers might have answered the calls on billboards to join the Ukrainian Army Brigade. The signs were posted in all around the city of 1.5 million inhabitants in northeastern Ukraine. Nearly 100 recruits gathered, posted all around the city. And on Saturday, on January 29th, in an empty school to take lessons on the basics of Army life, handling weapons, orientation, operational movement, theory on explosives, and every Saturday a team holds training sessions. War with Russia is quite possible because it is a country where a small number of people can decide of such things. The worst thing for me would be to find myself holed up in a shelter without knowing what to do, Alexei Sus, a 36-year-old electrical engineer, advised. He's been enlisted in the Territorial Defense Forces for 6 months. The young reservist spent nearly 10,000, hryvnias, that's about 313 euros, it's about $350 to buy his own equipment, uniform, first aid kit, tactical vest, gas mask, and even a Geiger counter, which he takes out of his bag. He acquired it in 2014, shortly after war broke out between loyalists and Russian-backed Donbass separatists. That's in the eastern part and the northern part of Ukraine, Donbass. And then there's a second a separatist movement situated right next to Donbass. So we were open to conflict with a nuclear-armed army at the time, and I wanted to be ready for any eventuality, he said, proudly showing the small white box that measured the level of radioactivity in the air. Well, the civilian soldiers of the territorial defense all equipped themselves at their own expenses. The old Kalashnikovs used for their training always remain at the base. The weapons would only be distributed in the event of an invasion. Meanwhile, with a permit, you can keep only a hunting gun at home, explains Alexei Sus. That's not enough for him. The reservist has been saving up for his dream weapon, a U.S.-made Kel-Tec RFB-308 assault rifle. Alexei is the typical territorial defense recruit. Men were full of patriotism and keen to be part of the defense effort, but unwilling to quit their jobs and civilian life to join the regular army. According to Sergeant Instructor Mikhail Sokolov, about 20% of the volunteers are women, but only a handful attended the training. Well, Alisa Bolotskaya is one of them, taking part in a moving exercise with a group in the schoolyard. The instructor urged the recruits to make quick, precise movements, to raise their rifles in front of them until it becomes automatic. The 52-year-old woman crept across a thin layer of snow covered on her flank by another reservist in camouflage who happened to be her partner. I am a nurse during the day, and for me it is an obligation as a health worker to join the Territorial Defense Forces. I want to use my professional experience to save as many lives as possible if the situation gets out of hand. It is really unstable now, but we hope we won't have to put everything we learn here into practice. There has been a considerable spike in the number of new recruits since early January, Training Sergeant Mikhail Sokolov. Although precise figures are not publicly available, the recruitment campaign is undoubtedly gaining momentum because of renewed tensions with Russia. The Ukrainian government is openly accelerating the development of the territorial defense forces with the goal of having as many as 130,000 reservists who could be stationed in the country's 25 regions. This open effort for recruitment from Kiev has fueled speculation that this would be an army of partisans, end quote, created to fight Russian forces in the advent of a military occupation of Ukraine. While some volunteers, such as Alexei Seuss, indeed signed up for this reason, the Territorial Defense Forces training is far too basic to produce fighters with resistance skills. Here, volunteers are given basic soldier training, which is not enough to fight behind enemy lines. Partisans would need to learn how to make explosives, hide their identities, or act as spies. And this requires special psychological skills, Oleg, one of Kharkiv Group's instructors, advised. The 45-year-old geologist, who has already been tested against Russian units in the Donbas conflict, estimates that about 10% of the territorial defense forces could effectively operate behind Russian lines. But after training, nurse reservist Alisa Bolotskaya and her partner put those concerns aside for the evening. The couple changed from military clothing to their civilian outfits, headed to Kharkiv's circus, joining the long line of attendees. And this was a premiere for a new show called Waterland. Is it enough to distract from the saber rattling at the border? At least until their next training session. And so that is what's happening there. One second. And this is very interesting as well, what's going on the ground. One second. Kharkiv seems to be resilient as it faces the threat of a Russian invasion. Seems that the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv has drawn international attention since the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, signaled the threat of a Russian occupation of the city last week. And for their part, local residents criticize the Ukrainian leader's remarks. They say they are more fearful that destabilization operation could intensify. The morning ritual at Alexeyevka Primary School in Kharkiv looks much like any other the world over, except perhaps that in the bitter chill of minus 10 degrees centigrade, it's about 30 degrees below zero. The usual buggies give way to luges and mini sleds in conveying the youngest children to school along ice roads. But on the wintry Thursday, what is really casting a chill for the parents of those school children is the recent spate of bomb scares levied against dozens of schools across the country. 3 days ago, it was Alexeyevka's return with pupils evacuated over a bomb threat while police officers and bomb disposal experts searched the building for explosives. The teacher called to tell me that the evacuation hadn't been a drill because the SBU, that's Ukraine Security Service, had received an anonymous tip saying there was a bomb at the school, recounted Yulia after dropping her little boy off on Thursday morning. There was no panic, and my seven-year-old son wasn't scared. He was only concerned about having left his bag at the school. But I was afraid myself because the police never managed to locate the perpetrators of these threats, despite their technical resources, and Yulia was all the more disturbed to learn via the media that every school in Zaporizhia, which is about 250 kilometers to the south, had been hit with bomb scares at the same time. Unbelievable. It is just that sort of diffused threat that weighs on the atmosphere in Kharkiv, a city of 1.5 million people, just 40 kilometers from the Russian border. Given its history and its largely Russian-speaking population, the city would be an obvious target for its neighbor. President Zelensky's remarks on January 20, surmising that Russia could seek to capture Kharkiv, raised existing tensions another notch. It's stupid on the president's part to say things like that because it can only breed panic, and panic is exactly what will make it easier to invade Ukraine, said Sergei Gotch, another parent dropping his child off to school at Alexeyevka. The refrain is a familiar one in Kharkiv. Residents lament the recent tendency to focus on the sheer scope of Russia's massive military deployment, only to lose sight of what they see as the essential, an incessant psychological warfare. Far from the time-honored blitzkrieg-type scenarios, the blanket artillery fire, the surging tanks, the invasion of ground troops, local officials and academics are more worried about an intensification of destabilizing operations. The biggest threat at the moment is to have terrorist attacks. They've used it before. Since 2014, 10 attacks have been foiled by security services, and two have been successful. Yulia Bidenko, a professor at Karazin University in Kharkiv, said. She also cites cyber attacks, the amplified broadcasting reach of television transmitters on the Russian side of the border in 2017, and the false alarm threats against hospitals and schools as elements in Russia's strategic arsenal. The resurgence of bomb threats is clearly linked to the international tension, said Dmytro Buchlard, a municipal official elected in Kharkiv. Sorry. In the past, an anonymous tip that could be traced was sent from Russia or the territories held by separatists in the Donbas region, said Buchlard, who is also director of Kharkiv's anti-corruption center. The Russians are trying to destabilize the country and to provoke chaos. That has unfortunately already had an impact on the economy, he added. We see it in the decreased value of the national currency and in the decision some technology firms have had to outsource their personnel to Western Ukraine or to Poland. Well, no one wants to become Russian, that's for sure. East of downtown, the prevailing geopolitical strain means continuing hardship at Kharkiv's Barabashovo market, one of Central Europe's largest. Several shops appear to be shut on the day that was visited by, and 75 hectares of commercial labyrinth, which once enjoyed the fruit of its prime location on the trade route between Ukraine and Russia. I had to take a second job in my son's company to maintain my standard of living because business here fell after 2017, said Peter Opioto Peroboshikov, a salesman in a handbag shop. So before, more than half of the buyers came from Russia, from Donetsk and from Luhansk, at the other territory, and near Donbas. So now they can't travel here easily anymore, and they have to take detours, he explained. Everyone here wants to trade with Russia, but no one wants to become Russian. So that's the story, and that's where we sit today. Anyway, so let me quickly look at the calendar for tomorrow. Bear with me a moment. One second. For tomorrow, we're only going to have the Driving Me Crazy duo. We're going to hear from their review. And then it's on Friday when we're going to be speaking to Assembly Member Nader Sayers, assuming he is allowed to return home from Albany. He's the New York State Assembly Member representing District 90. He was there actually last Friday, and we thought he'd be available Monday. He was not. He's still up there. And so he couldn't attend Monday's show. And now it's already Wednesday. And the hope was that Wednesday would be his last day up there, but we'll have to see. You never know. So on Friday, we have him scheduled from 10 to 11. And then at 11 o'clock, we're going to speak to U.S. Army Rangers that Tom Amenta and Dan Berkeley. And so we're going to get quite a bit of insight into how they relate what happened in Afghanistan with what's happening in Ukraine, and their knowledge of 20 years in the military. It's going to be absolutely stupendous. I'm very much looking forward to hearing their input and to gain their knowledge. It should be really, really fascinating. Okay, so let me quickly look to see what else we've got here. I think I'm missing something here. Okay, for some reason I lost the file. One second. One moment here. Well, we're going to be closing down and shutting down the show, but I have to get to the studio screen. And, oh, yeah, here we are now. Get to the studio screen and wish you a thank you for joining us today. Of course, our main guest, Yonkers City Court Justice, the Honorable Ada Medina, so who was recently designated and placed into office by none other than Mayor Mike Spano. So that's going to be really very interesting. Anyway, we'll speak to you tomorrow when we get the review from John and Lori Wiles, and they tested a Kia, and you can already read it on the Yonkers Tribune website to get a sense of what it's going to be like, and they'll review it tomorrow morning from 10 to 10:30. Take care and be well. Goodbye.